In a manner of speaking, I guess you could say that this next section of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond could be termed fun with science. That is a tongue-in-cheek term that I've applied to a number of programs dealing with matters scientific and medical. On October 20th of last year, that year being 1996, for the benefit of people who eventually hear this program on tape, it was my privilege to interview Dr. Alan Cantwell, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and Ed Haslam, the author of Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, two of them via phone hookup and two of them live here in the studio. Among the issues we talked about were not only the use of genetic engineering as applied to biological warfare, something we'll be talking about at greater length this evening, but also the very real possibility that diseases such as AIDS and Ebola might not be natural diseases, but rather may have been deliberately created in order to basically eliminate undesirable people, and that both diseases, AIDS and Ebola, might very well represent the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. Among the other issues that we talked about in that program, and an issue that I have discussed in a number of programs since that time, concerns the contamination of vaccines with various monkey viruses and other things that are deleterious to human health. And in particular, the landmark book Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, authored by Ed Haslam, discusses the contamination of the polio vaccine in the late 1950s and early 1960s with a cancer-causing monkey virus entitled basically called SV40, or Simian Virus 40. Ed Haslam believes that that contamination of the polio vaccine with SV40 may have led to, among other things, a soft tissue cancer epidemic that appears to be afflicting the United States at this time. It is also the opinion of Ed Haslam, and I think his opinion is in all probability on very solid ground, that the contamination of the polio vaccine may have very well led to experimentation with the SV40, and that some of that experimentation may have ultimately led to the creation of AIDS. And indeed, it is possible that some of the research being done into the SV40 contamination of the polio vaccine may very well have been conducted in New Orleans under the auspices of Dr. Mary Sherman, an associate of David Ferry, the principal focus, at least initially, of Jim Garrison's investigation of the Kennedy assassination in New Orleans. In a section, in a segment, entitled Fun with Science that I aired some weeks ago, or that I recorded some weeks ago, I discussed the debate currently underway about the contamination of the polio vaccine with SV40 and its relationship to cancers now appearing in the American population. An article appeared in the Los Angeles Times on Wednesday, March 12th of 1997, dealing with the growing debate about vaccines in the United States and their safety. This article itself is a rather tame article. I don't think it's particularly remarkable in any regard. It is, however, significant in that it discusses Dr. Leonard Horowitz, albeit very briefly, and his hypothesis that some vaccines may have been contaminated, perhaps deliberately, and that that may have resulted in the transmission of AIDS and other diseases to targeted populations. Now, of course, Leonard Horowitz has dealt with this at great length in his landmark book, Emerging Viruses, that I've dealt with at considerable length on this program, and that I will be dealing with again in future broadcasts. However, because this article did appear on the front page of a major daily newspaper, namely the Los Angeles Times, of Wednesday, March 12th of 1997. I thought it might be worth discussing and worth going into. This article, again, from the front page of the LA Times, Wednesday, March 12th, 1997, is by Julie Marcus, or Marquise, M-A-R-Q-U-I-S, an LA Times staff writer. It's headlined, A Vocal Attack on Vaccines, and it's subtitled, Media-savvy skeptics are using stories of tragedy to claim that inoculations may do more harm than good. Health officials say such ideas endanger the public. At core of controversy is a question of risk and reality. Most of the article consists of a poo-pooing of the notion that vaccines may be unsafe by various medical, quote, experts, unquote. Note the quotes. Some of them may be experts, but it would appear from the context that some of them have a vested interest in seeing to it that the public does not become alarmed about the contamination of vaccines. And to make a long story short, what I find inadequate about their discussion is that they tend to polarize the argument about the safety of vaccines into either you unquestioningly take the vaccines or have your children take the vaccines, or else you will be irresponsible and perhaps could lead to an epidemic of some kind. I think that the critics of vaccination programs have a lot of validity to their criticism. I think, however, that the issue is not whether to vaccinate or not, but rather as to the safety of the production process of some of these vaccines. One of the major points that the critics have made is that it would be possible to make safe vaccines using somewhat different procedures, but that the vaccines that are being produced now are still contaminated with various things like monkey viruses, and that the contamination continues to occur because the vaccines are being manufactured in such a way as to maximize profits, that a somewhat more expensive and consequently less profitable manufacturing process could render these vaccines safe. And I think rather than the to vaccinate or not to vaccinate, I think the debate would be more intelligently framed on the issue of whether or not to manufacture vaccines that are safe and consequently to exhibit a lower profit on the marketing of those vaccines, something the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry has been reluctant to do. But I think rather than accusing the critics of the vaccines of being irresponsible and possibly leading to future epidemics through the failure to vaccinate their children, I think the debate would be more intelligently focused on how to make the vaccines for human use and how to make them safe. And again, I think that the criticism that the medical experts here have of the critics of the vaccination program is on thin ground and is poorly framed for reasons that I hope I have adequately explained. Skipping down in this article of some of the critics of the vaccination programs, the article says, as blasphemous as critics' words are to many health officials, the doggedness of Fisher's group and its willingness to work within the system have paid off. 11 years ago, allying itself temporarily with lawsuit-weary drug companies, the National Vaccine Information Center played a major role in establishing a no-fault federal compensation program for patients injured by vaccines. More recently, the center and other parent groups backed a successful attempt to improve the safety of polio and whooping cough or pertussis inoculations. Last year, medical authorities recommended switching babies to another type of pertussis vaccine called, quote, acellular, unquote, to reduce the risk of adverse reactions. And the country is phasing in inactivated polio shots to reduce the number of people, 8 to 10 reported cases a year, who get polio from the live oral vaccine. Now, Fisher's group is questioning the need for mass vaccinations against usually mild childhood illnesses, such as chickenpox, or diseases often linked to high-risk adult behavior such as hepatitis B and, perhaps eventually, AIDS. Next on the Vaccine Information Center's agenda pushing for more research into potential... pushing for more research into potential consequences of vaccine contamination by animal viruses. In January, Fisher was invited to a federally sponsored scientific workshop about a monkey virus, SV40, which contaminated the oral polio vaccine 4 decades ago. Fisher dubbed the gathering a desperate attempt at, quote, damage control, unquote, and one government official called her presence, quote, distracting, unquote. But the invitation alone is testimony to her growing sway. I think we've earned a place at the table, she said. Fisher sits on the National Institute of Medicine's brainstorming committee on vaccine safety with Dr. Richard Johnston, medical director of the March of Dimes. He is complimentary of her work, but warns against abandoning empiricism for emotion. And by the way, that Fisher is Barbara Lowe, or Lowy Fisher, L-O-E, who co-founded the Vaccine Information Center. And skipping down still further into this article, we read, lay critics have enlisted some allies with flashy credentials, dissident doctors and scientists with unproven yet increasingly publicized notions. Dr. W. John Martin, a USC professor, and Howard Urnovitz, U-R-N-O-V-I-T-Z, an independent Berkeley microbiologist, have suggested that simian viruses introduced by the oral polio vaccine cultured in monkey tissue may indeed be contributing to chronic human diseases, cancer, or AIDS. The two scientists who work separately are not anti-vaccine. But Martin appeared on the Carol and Marilyn segment last year to push for full disclosure of vaccine risks. Ernovitz, who carves time from a busy schedule to field media calls, says he has been urged by health officials not to, quote, create a panic, unquote. No one has ever been angry with a weather person for saying a storm is 3 days away from the coast, he said. I'm just here to upgrade the system, unquote. Dentist and Harvard-trained health educator Len Horowitz publicly theorizes in lectures that AIDS and Ebola viruses were passed, possibly intentionally, to humans through tainted vaccines. By the way, Len Horowitz was also on the faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health. Continuing, and of course, Len Horowitz is the author of the vitally important recent book, Emerging Viruses, that I've dealt with at considerable length, and a segment dealing with Len Horowitz's book, a half-hour segment dealing with Len Horowitz's book, and also some of the research of Dr. Garth Nicholson, about whom we're going to hear more in just a minute, is available from Spitfire, as is a long 3-hour interview with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, Dr. Alan Cantwell, Ed Haslam, and also Dr. Garth Nicholson. There's also a 3-hour interview with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Fairy and the Monkey Virus, available for people who would like to follow up on this research. I would also recommend that they get a hold of an hour-long program from Spitfire entitled Fun with Science, in which I deal with some of these issues. Continuing. Then there's medical historian Harris L. Coulter, C-O-U-L-T-E-R, who contends in a 1990 book that vaccinations may lead to, quote, social violence, unquote, and, quote, criminality, unquote. Even medical father figures have broken ranks. Take Dr. Lendon Smith, an elderly Oregon pediatrician and author, best known for dozens of appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. A charming homespun conversationalist, he appears with Goldenberg on Susan Powter to advise against all vaccinations except, quote, maybe tetanus, unquote. Now, I would not be prepared. Of course, I'm not a medical official. I would not be prepared to go that far. But rather, I think the issues here are manufacturing vaccines that are safe. And beyond that, there remains the issue of the deliberate contamination of vaccines in order to vector populations for the purposes of waging biological warfare and possibly genocide as well. Hence, the inclusion of this issue in this program, in this broadcast. Continuing. A charming homespun, and resuming with the last segment I touched on, a charming homespun conversationalist, Dr. Lendon Smith, appeared with Goldenberg on Susan Powter to advise against all vaccinations except, quote, maybe tetanus, unquote. These men, whom the public sees as experts, should mind their mouths, and Johnston, said Johnston, of the March of Dimes. It is great to have hypotheses, but it is not correct to confuse the public about what is hypothesis and what is fact, he said. Given the conflicting claims and the importance of the debate, some physicians believe they can't afford not to provide detailed counseling to parents on vaccine risks and benefits. Indeed. And one of the, I think that's that last point is well taken. One of the reasons why I'm focusing on the issue of vaccines here is because with the focal point of this broadcast being the national security establishment and international fascism, not only have vaccines been accidentally contaminated with monkey viruses, which appear to be deleterious to human health, but there remains the issue of genetic engineering and the deliberate contamination of vaccines for the purposes, as I said, of vectoring certain populations, perhaps even for the purposes of exterminating them. In a segment that I dealt with, in a segment, actually 2 half-hour segments, dealing with Persian Gulf War Syndrome, I reprised part of the 3-hour interview that I had with Dr. Garth Nicholson, who along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some pioneering research on Persian Gulf War Syndrome, and in particular has examined an apparently genetically altered microorganism entitled a mycoplasma that appears to be responsible for much of Persian Gulf War Syndrome. And in much of the rest of this particular half-hour segment, we're going to be focusing again on the research of Dr. Garth and Nancy Nicholson, because their research, including some details that were not included in that previous pair of half-hour segments dealing with Persian Gulf War Syndrome, some of their research was discussed in a front-page article that appeared in the Los Angeles Times of Sunday, March 9th of 1997. This article is by J.R. Moringer, M-O-E-H-R-I-N-G-E-R, of the L.A. Times. It's datelined Irvine, California, and headlined, Gulf War Syndrome Feared to be Contagious. Subheaded, some doctors say they've caught the ailment from veterans. Others insist the claim lacks evidence. The article reads as follows. A number of medical professionals who say they've become ill while treating Gulf War veterans claim the mysterious disease afflicting tens of thousands of soldiers is contagious and could pose a public health threat. Doctors, nurses, laboratory researchers, as well as others who come in casual contact with Gulf War veterans, say they've contracted the same symptoms, fatigue, fever, aches, rashes, and respiratory problems that are generally associated with Gulf War syndrome, unquote. Government investigators, as well as some prominent scientists, express deep skepticism about such theories, and they find little evidence to support the claim that Gulf War illnesses are contagious. But despite failing to find favor with official Washington and colleagues, many remain convinced that the cause of Gulf War illness is an infectious microbe either native to the Middle East or produced by Iraq's infamous biological weapons program. Whatever the cause, they say, it's spreading. By the way, I would interject that in the October 20th, 1996 interview with Dr. Nicholson, we examined the very real possibility that the Iraqi scientists may have gotten that particular apparently genetically altered microorganism, the mycoplasma, from the West, probably the United States, either directly or through the technological know-how that permitted them to develop that organism. And significantly, the organism contains a gene from the HIV, the AIDS virus, which enables it to produce a protein sheath or a protein shell, which permits it to invade cells and to hide from the human immune system. There is also the possibility that this microorganism may have entered into some of the troops who were coming down with Persian Gulf War syndrome as a result of vaccines. Continuing, and resuming with the last sentence, but despite failing to find favor with official Washington and colleagues, many remain convinced that the cause of Gulf War illness is an infectious microbe, either native to the Middle East or produced by Iraq's infamous biological weapons program. Whatever the cause, they say, it's spreading. As proof, they cite themselves. Everyone in this office has had Gulf War illness, said Garth Nicholson, an Irvine biochemist at the nonprofit Institute for Molecular Medicine, which he founded to investigate Gulf War syndrome and other chronic conditions. Quote, I lost four teeth and had part of my lower jaw removed, unquote. The inspiration for Nicholson's Irvine Institute, which opened its doors to Gulf War veterans in August, was his daughter-in-law, a 101st Airborne Division soldier who became ill after her unit penetrated deep into Iraq during the 1991 conflict. Practically everyone in her unit came down with Gulf War illness, said Nicholson, who at that time was heading the tumor biology department of the renowned MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. We found out a lot of people in the service were becoming sick, and we'd seen similar illnesses before, unquote. After intense clinical research and thorough examinations of his daughter-in-law, Nicholson and his biophysicist wife, Nancy, concluded that Gulf War illness could be treated with massive doses of antibiotics. She's fully recovered, he said, of his daughter-in-law. She's going to be entering medical school, unquote. Until recently, many suspected that Gulf War illnesses were caused by chemical weapons. Nicholson and others, however, say chemical weaponry has been a red herring. He contends that the leading culprit may be a bacterium such as Mycoplasma fermentans, F-E-R-M-E-N-T-A-N-S, which he claims to have found in the blood of 45% of the ailing veterans he's tested. Perhaps genetically altered by the Iraqis or their weapons suppliers, note that would be us, I'm interjecting parenthetically, Mycoplasma fermentans might have been a biological warfare agent used in warheads that exploded above Allied troop positions during the Persian Gulf conflict, Nicholson contends. Or it may have been dispersed in some other way by the Iraqis. Such theories have circulated among investigators for some time, but have failed to win many converts in Washington. We saw Mycoplasma fermentans as a highly unlikely candidate for biological warfare, said Dr. Shi-Ching Lo, chief of the Division of Molecular Pathology at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington. He recently studied Nicholson's data and found it inconclusive. If 50% of veterans were infected, we anticipate they would have a much higher incidence of antibody response, but we did not really see that, Lowe said. By the way, I would interject that perhaps the fact that the organism, that is to say the Mycoplasma fermentans, has apparently been genetically altered to give it the protein sheath gene, the protein shell gene from AIDS, which permits it to, again, enter into cells, or from the HIV, I should say, which permits it to enter into cells and thereby hide from the human immune system for a long time, that might have something to do with the fact that there was not a higher incidence of antibody response. Again, that is the viewpoint of a layman, but I don't find Mr. Lowe's arguments particularly convincing here, particularly in light of considerable evidence of an ongoing cover-up of the Persian Gulf War syndrome situation. Continuing. In its final report 2 months ago, the Presidential Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illnesses also discounted Nicholson's arguments about the likely source of Gulf War syndrome. Quote, clinical evidence seems to indicate that mycoplasma is not a source of widespread illness in Gulf War veterans, said Mark Brown, a senior policy analyst on the committee, which will continue to oversee Pentagon investigations into Gulf War illnesses. What clinical evidence? Nicholson asked. They've never presented any clinical evidence that mycoplasma wasn't involved, because all signs and symptoms of Gulf War illness can be caused by mycoplasmal infections, unquote. Despite the committee's findings, doctors at Walter Reed Army Medical Center near Washington recently agreed to work with Nicholson. Quote, a protocol for evaluating Dr. Nicholson's work is being developed now, said Walter Reed spokesman Ben Smith. Everybody involved with Gulf War illness, all the folks here at Walter Reed and elsewhere have said we'll look at anything that'll help patients, unquote. The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, after hearing testimony from many worried veterans, has vowed to investigate the contagion question. Quote, we've had lots of veterans testify that they are concerned that they are passing on these illnesses to their wives and children, said Charles Battaglia, B-A-T-T-A-G-L-I-A, the committee's staff director. It's one of the things we'll be looking at as part of the investigation this committee is conducting, unquote. Joyce Riley, R-I-L-E-Y, a former Air Force flight nurse in Houston, testified before the committee that she became ill while treating soldiers who returned from the Gulf War. Though she never left the United States during her tour of duty, she quickly began to show symptoms identical to those of her patients, including the debilitating chronic fatigue that now afflicts many veterans. At one point, Riley said, she was too weak to brush her teeth. When Riley recovered, thanks, she says, to intravenous antibiotics similar to those used on Nicholson's daughter, she founded the American Gulf War Veterans Association, a Texas-based organization that answers veterans' questions and collects data on their health. She was lucky, she says, because she received prompt medical attention. Thousands of veterans have died, she believes, because their conditions went unrecognized and misdiagnosed. Among the veterans who have contacted her organization, Riley says, 80% report that they've transmitted their illness to at least one other person, including children, neighbors, and coworkers. Many veterans even describe bizarre symptoms in their household pets. And this is one of the new things that Dr. Nicholson did not mention in our interview. Continuing. Here's the scary part, she said. When I talk to veterans, I ask, how are the children doing? And they say, well, my little boy cries at night because his muscles ache so bad. And I say, tell me about your pets. And they tell me, well, our pets died, unquote. By the way, this would suggest the possibility that the organism could be communicated to animals from people and perhaps the other way around. Continuing, frequently, Riley hears from physicians who were sick and scared. A doctor called me the other day, and he's been treating Gulf War veterans, she said. Both his prize dogs are dragging their back legs, and he's sick too, unquote. Dr. Kathy Leisure of Lebanon, Pennsylvania, has no doubt that the illness is an infectious disease. She has treated 600 Gulf War veterans and one day noted a Gulf War-type rash on her nose. Even now, people are getting the illness, she said. Said Nicholson, Saddam Hussein threatened to carry the war back to America. This is one way he could do that, unquote. One of Nicholson's supporters is Dr. Edward S. Hyman, H-Y-M-A-N, a New Orleans physician who has treated nearly a dozen Gulf War veterans without becoming ill himself, though he checks himself regularly for unusual bacteria he believes responsible for Gulf War illness. Hyman, who has testified before Congress about Gulf War illness, has warned that the nation's blood supply, much of which is donated by active duty military personnel, may be unsafe. It's conceivable, said Hyman, who asked that Gulf War illness who added that Gulf War illness behaves like the bacterial infections he has studied for 30 years. Quote, I'm not the kind of guy who screams germ warfare when there's no evidence of it, though I have better evidence than most anybody, unquote. Dr. Charles Hinshaw of Wichita, Kansas, agrees. A former president of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, he hasn't become sick treating Gulf War veterans, but he believes that many of their illnesses are contagious. He handles their blood with great care. If I was running the Red Cross, he said, or I was part of the Department of Defense, I'd say, let's don't take any more blood from veterans until we answer this question, unquote. Officials at the American Red Cross, which collects 50% of the nation's blood supply, dismiss such concerns. We make sure before we collect blood from anybody that they feel well, that they're in good health, and have normal temperature and pulse, said Dr. Peter L. Page, Senior Medical Officer for Biomedical Services at the American Red Cross. Those practices have protected transfusions very well over the decades from bacterial contamination. But Nicholson and others charge that because Mycoplasma fermentans and some other bacteria have long incubation periods, carriers may not always display outward symptoms of illness. More than 5 years after the war's end, quote, we're just now beginning to see secondhand exposures in physicians and nurses, unquote, said Nicholson, adding, again quoting, this is not going to go away, just slowly spread, unquote. It spread like wildfire throughout his office. Besides himself and his wife, five staffers came down with the classic symptoms of Gulf War illness. There are 123 different possible symptoms, said Blake Hale, 22, a member of Nicholson's staff, which includes physicians and chemists. I've experienced probably three-quarters of those, unquote. Some of Hale's friends had trouble believing that his recent sickness was in any way connected to the Gulf War because he's never spent a day in the military. But such skeptics have an even harder time believing the recovery he's made. Along with everyone else in Nicholson's office, he feels just fine after receiving treatment with antibiotics. The drugs don't cure the disease, doctors say, but they do control the symptoms. Among Nicholson's most dramatic treatment successes is Dr. Larry Goss, G-O-S-S, of Walters, Oklahoma. When Goss and his wife began suffering from severe chronic fatigue several years ago, they couldn't imagine the cause. Gulf War syndrome never occurred to them because neither had served in the military. As his wife's condition deteriorated into something resembling multiple sclerosis, a common diagnosis, Goss said, among Gulf War veterans who were sick, Goss heard about Nicholson's research. It was only then that Goss began to wonder whether his volunteer work with local Gulf War veterans had caused his illness and that of his wife. At Nicholson's suggestion, the Gosses took massive doses of an antibiotic called doxycycline, that's D-O-X-Y-C-Y-C-L-I-N-E. Almost instantly, both felt better. Quote, she threw away her cane, unquote, Goss said, and no longer needed her wheelchair, unquote. Since his dramatic recovery, and especially his wife's, Goss has become a firm believer in Nicholson's theories. For little or no money, he examines hundreds of Gulf War veterans, many of whom come long distances, all of whom seem terribly frightened. I'm just a country doctor who got sick and saw a lot of my patients sick and didn't know what was going on, he said. I'm no expert. I don't think anyone is. We need to learn more, unquote. Said Riley, it's startling. We're sitting on top of a contagious disease and doing nothing about it, unquote. And I would add that maybe a contagious disease that can be passed from people to animals and the other way around that may be contaminating our blood supply, according to some of the fears expressed here. And again, this particular mycoplasma has a gene from HIV spliced into it to make it more pathogenic. That concludes this particular half-hour segment. Thanks for listening.